Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and I'm here with our senior fellow, André Sapir. Hi, André. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for having me.
And for today's episode, we will be discussing about the global trade landscape as seen from Australia with Tim Yind. Tim was appointed Associate Secretary in the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade with responsibility for trade and investment. He has over 30 years' experience at the highest levels of government and in the international system, providing strategic direction and vision on trade and related issues. And at The Sound of Economics, we have the privilege to host him today, not via a remote call, but in person, in our recording studio in Brussels. Tim, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Thanks very much, Giuseppe. It's a great pleasure to be here and looking forward to the discussion. I just should, at the outset, just mention one thing. You may be aware that in Australia, you are currently going through an election campaign, an election period, and there are various conventions that I have to respect given this election that's taking place. So I will be very happy to engage in the discussion on a factual basis, and I think that we can have a very good discussion nevertheless, and I'm happy and looking forward to being able to put forward Australian perspectives on various issues. So,
thank you so much for this clarification, and of course we will respect the democratic process in Australia and ensure that this conversation is also, fairly respecting the rules over there. But just for our listeners, a little bit more of a background about yourself, because before assuming your current role in November last year, you worked at the World Trade Organization as a principal advisor and chief of staff of former Director General Roberto Azevedo and the current Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. You also led the World Trade Organization's engagement with G20 leaders as WTO Sherpa. So there are very few people in a better position than you to provide us with an overview about the current state of the global trade environment, which it would help a lot our listeners to better understand also the Australian perspective, on which we would like to touch more in depth during our conversation. So I would like to ask you to provide us with such an insight to kick off our conversation.
Well, no, thanks very much, and I'm very happy to do that. And I mean, the first thing I would say is that I do have, through my career, both in Australian government, but at the WTO for the last 8 years until the end of last year, I've had a very long and productive working relationship with the EU. And I think that at the moment, given the complex environment and challenges that we face globally, that partnership is more important than ever. Certainly, as we look at the global economy, while the overall picture is in many respects for continued recovery in response to the pandemic, obviously there are some real challenges before us that could impact on that and send us in the wrong direction. The developments of recent months in Ukraine is of great concern to Australia. We've responded robustly to the Russian invasion through a series of measures, including some very strong trade measures. But there's also concerns around inflation and indeed the pandemic itself and how we respond. So I think certainly with regard to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it has set global recovery back, and we've seen the IMF project sort of reductions in global growth. And of course, it could worsen further depending on developments there and the impact on the global economy. As I said, we've responded robustly to Russia's actions, including things like an across-the-board 35% tariff to block Russian imports. We've taken some quite significant measures on energy-related products. We have put a ban on our export of alumina to Russia. All of this is to show a very strong and robust position of Australia, working very closely with like-minded countries, including the EU, of course, who we are in very, very close contact with. As I said, we are concerned, if we look at the global economy, with the trends in inflation that are concerning. Many countries will see a likely response through interest rates, etc. But the trend and what's happening with inflation will be something that we're watching very carefully. And we have, of course, seen in the US inflation hit a 40-year high. In terms of the pandemic, and I mean, we would say we have to keep watching this very carefully. I mean, we just have to look at what's going on in China at the moment in terms of rising numbers and the possible impacts that we could see on economic activity in China. China's such a strong and important economic player globally. I think we're still coming out of the pandemic too. I mean, there've been a lot of restrictions in place, certainly in Australia as well. And, I think things are trending in a positive direction in this regard, but I think we need to keep an eye on that as well. So it's a complicated global economic picture at the moment, a complicated strategic environment that we're operating in. Australia very much wants to work with like-minded partners to face these challenges. And as I said at the outset, working with the EU and other like-minded countries is a critical part of how we respond to these challenges.
Thank you. André, you've been analysing those issues here at Bruegel. So what are your first impressions and comments on what we just heard from Tim?
I think we heard a very interesting viewpoint, not surprising, because indeed the EU and Australia are like-minded countries. So we are both facing the same environment and the same economic, geostrategic environment. We are not located in the same parts of the world, but nonetheless, I think we are broadly facing the same environment. And I think we are analyzing what is happening in similar manners. So indeed, in that sense, we are like-minded. But I want to push Tim a little further on the terrain he did not enter, which is the WTO. Now, let me preface my remarks with the following elements. And I'm really going to ask you a question, but I'm going to first sort of give you my assessment, but my assessment with a lot of question marks. Now, when I look at, let's say, globalization, let's use that term. When I look at globalization, I'm not going to make a whole history of globalization starting from the middle of the 19th century. But if I look at globalization over the last, let's say, 50 years, I would say there have been two clear phases, and now we are entering in the third one, which is where the question marks are and where I would like to hear your viewpoint. Now, I would say there was a period up to, let's call it 1989-1990. Now, why 1989? 1989 is obviously the Berlin Wall, the beginning of the changes that then take 2-3 years in the Soviet Union. And there are also important changes taking place, or important events and changes taking part in China. And up to the late 80s, the world organizations, not yet the WTO, the GATT at the time, but in a sense some sister or cousin organizations in Washington, the World Bank and the IMF. So all of those organizations created at the end of World War II, sort of those global economic governance institutions. They are global institutions, but they are not really global because China is not a member. And the Soviet Union is not a member, and some of the socialist countries around the Soviet Union are not members. Some are already, but some are not. And then in the 1990s, first for the IMF and the World Bank, and then in the 2000s, China, Russia, and other former Soviet republics, including Ukraine, obviously, do become members of all of those institutions. And that's the period also, not only because of the political change, but yes, the political change obviously takes a huge role to play, and liberalization, but there's also what's happening on the technological side. We have the period of fast globalization, what some people have called hyper-globalization. And that's a period that goes roughly from, you know, the early 1990s up to 2008, right? And then comes the Great Recession, the collapse of trade in 2009, recovery, and then the pandemic. And now we are in the environment, the geopolitical environment, with the war in Ukraine, with the positions of different countries, including China, in this series of events. And then comes the question mark. That's when I'm turning back to you with my question mark. So we had the period up to 1989, 1990. Then we have a period, clearly 20 years, two decades, the 1990s and the 2000s, with the global institution, everybody on board, not necessarily everybody like-minded, but everybody sharing the same rules and being at the same table on those economic governance. And then series of events. There have already been some frictions with China in recent years, and now comes a harder event, the war between Ukraine and Russia, and countries positioning themselves in that. And so my question is, it's a question that I pose myself, but that I take advantage to pose to you as well, is how do you see the years coming forward? Are we now entering into a third phase? Okay, so up to 1989, the 20 years after that, and then what had already started in with the financial crisis, the pandemic, and now the war. We entered into a third phase. And what does this phase mean? Does this phase mean that we're going back to the period 1989? In the meantime, everybody's sharing the same institution. And the world has become much more global, as we have become much more intertwined, not just because we are sitting at the same table, but because business is intertwined. So we are not going back to before 1989, but in part we are. And that's where my question is: How do you look at the period that we have entered? How would you characterize it, and how would you characterize the years ahead?
Okay, thank you. It's a really good question, and in setting the scene in my original comments, I was thinking ahead to where do we go? What are the positive directions we can move in this complex environment? And notwithstanding the series of changes that have taken place over the 50 and how the global system of economic cooperation has evolved, one thing that from an Australian perspective has always been there is the importance of global rules, and that they govern trade between countries and provide a framework in which problems, disputes, etc., can be dealt with. And clearly that was a big part of the focus of the work that I was doing when I was at the World Trade Organization. We all know that the institution and the multilateral trading system faces many challenges, and that's why the discussion around reform is very important. But my sense is that is a discussion that we need to intensify and strengthen to take account of changes in the geostrategic landscape and the economic landscape. And certainly since I've returned to Australia, for a country like Australia, we would see ourselves as a significant, but a middle-sized, middle to large-sized economy, We need that system of rules to be able to conduct our international trade relations. And I think this is partly because of some of the challenges that we face at the moment. And you would know that at the moment, our relationship with China, there are a number of trade actions that China has taken against us. And an important part of the response to that is the global rules and our ability to prosecute our interests through the WTO. And we have actually initiated two disputes against China on agriculture-related items. So that remains of fundamental importance to us going forward. But I think for the reasons that you have alluded to, how the environment has been changing and evolving, this is why we are such a strong supporter of the discussion of WTO reform, because part of the response is to update the rules and to look at how we move work forward in the WTO. So the negotiating machinery needs to be looked at again. Clearly, we have to do everything we can to restore the dispute settlement function at the WTO. And Australia and the EU, I think, are playing a leading role in pushing for those kind of discussions. There have been some positive developments in recent years, in my view, that I certainly think are part of the discussion around reform, that the work around like-minded initiatives in electronic commerce, investment facilitation, the sense that those that want to move forward can move forward. Participation is open. These are all good principles that can help deal with some of the problems that have come up over the years where everyone has to agree to something for it to be able to go forward. It's a complicated discussion. It's even more complicated now, given the challenges that and the situation with the war. But I think that, again, we have such a strong interest in supporting and building a set of rules that are respected and that deal with these global challenges, including some of the challenges that we now see from the situation, whether it's our problems and what's going on in the Indo-Pacific region, our engagement with China, or the way that Russia has responded. I mean, we need to have a set of rules that are adhered to and, in an economic and trade sense, can deal with some of the problems around, the levels of state control and the way things are subsidised unfairly, and our ability to be able to use that system to respond to economic coercion, which, again, we certainly have been subject to. And I know we've been very supportively engaged and maintaining a dialogue with the EU and Lithuania when they have been subject to similar situation.
From a broader level, what you are both describing reconfirm once more that what André just said, that the times of easy globalization are over to a certain extent. So there is a lot of uncertainty about this new phase of globalization, as the question that was put on the table by André and your reply is telling us, but that seems characterized by an increasing use of economic tools for geopolitical purposes by single states rather than in multilateral context. So these tools can include everything from positive economic instruments, so trade deals, but also, as you were just mentioning in a second ago, coercive ones, which are more constraining the global trade. So while states are trying these different strategies, there is basically seems to be an alternation between positive tools and negative tools. And periods of escalating economic coercion will give way to a focus on strategic competition, vice versa. So the underlying trend seems to be a weaponization of economic relations. And it seems that this is something, at least we don't have any evidence that this is not yet there to remain for a while. So you just mentioned about the coercion tools used by China, but also there is cases for Russia, the United States and others. And it would be interesting to know a little bit more about how Australia has been reacting to those. But before that, I would like to ask André, because the European Union is also proposing to equip itself with a European anti-coercion instrument, which is being discussed at the moment. Could you perhaps tell us more about it? Because this gives also a little bit of a context how interesting it's going to be to hear from Australia for our European listeners.
So you're right that the European Commission, that in our system is to put forward proposals, right? So before we get European legislation, which in this case would need to be adopted by the European Parliament and by the Council, since the Senate of the 27 countries, the Commission has to put forward a proposal. And there's been for a while discussion about having a anti-coercion instrument, and I will explain in a minute what it means in greater details. But the discussion was there for several months, and then in December, last December 2021, the Commission did put forward formally its proposal, and now it is in the hands of Parliament and of the Council. Okay, and they have to, if the proposal will be adopted, they need to agree between themselves, and if they don't agree, it may go back to the Commission that would make a new proposal. So we are in this process now. The proposal has been put on the table, and it is being discussed by the member states, by the member states' governments, and by the European Parliament. But it's been a process for a while. Now, indeed, Australia has had some issues of coercion with China. There's been in the European Union one member state, Lithuania, as you mentioned, that has had also some trade measures being adopted by China as a result of China's displeasure towards Lithuania's recognition of Taiwan. And there had been already before this particular event, there were obviously the Trump administration with measures being taken by, not for geopolitical reasons, for reasons that actually we did not understand, but the steel measures and the threat that never materialized, but was nonetheless very disturbing, the Trump administration threat that they would impose, besides the steel and aluminum measures, also measures on automobile. And that was obviously, in Germany in particular, a very worrisome potential development that had already negative economic consequences, although the measures were not put into place. So this new environment has forced the European Union to reflect on how to position itself and what kind of instruments it has at its disposal, given the institutional setting, you know, and the treaty, obviously, and the role of the different elements, and, you know, when you need to act by a majority, when you need unanimity in certain areas, like foreign policy, like the sanctions that we are applying now to Russia, those have to be by unanimity. So there's been that discussion. You know, are we well equipped to deal with those measures or those threats? And the answer has been no. And that's why there's been a conversation for a while, given those events, and then the Commission came up with a proposal. No, it's not a proposal of coercion. It's a proposal of anti-coercion. It's ACI, anti-coercion instrument. And it's an instrument that, in the proposal by the Commission, would require two actions by third countries. So it's a reaction to an action by third countries, and needs to be a double element. One is a trade measure, trade in a broad sense, trade investment can be also related to intellectual property, for instance. But they need to be a measure applied by a foreign country, a third country. And that's the second condition, in a sense, to coerce the European Union or one of its member states to do certain things or not to do certain things in its political measures. In a sense, as it's discussed, it's about sort of limiting or autonomy. Third country saying, don't do this or do this, otherwise, or we're already putting a trade measure. Okay. So this is the instrument. So we are giving ourselves, or we would give ourselves, the liberty to... Some instruments already exist, but it has been a way to sort of deal with some of the instruments, some of the limitations to those instruments, including issues of unanimity, to give us a stronger hand in telling countries, beware. If you do this, we will counter. We will take countermeasures. We will take anti-coercion measures. That is, we will take also trade in a broad sense measures. And so you should be aware of this. Hopefully it would be a deterrent. But if you nonetheless are not being deterred, and there are various steps in the procedure, we would put those measures into place. Now, there's been a lot of discussion because some of the coercion measures, let's say the China measures, are really of a political nature. Okay, it's an economic tool that is used, but the reason here, it's not a measure to harm, in a sense, some producers in the European Union for that sake. The sake is to punish, in this case, Lithuania for a political decision that it has taken. The measures with the President Trump were maybe of a different nature, right? They were not political, they were really economic measures. And that opens a whole discussion also inside the European Union and potentially also with WTO about the nature of the measures and to what extent they are or not WTO compatible. So there are issues with third countries. Discussion would be interesting to hear, you know, from our Australian friend how they react. But there also there's also a discussion within the European Union because this would need to be adopted by all the European Union. And some countries are ill at ease with, in a sense, giving to the Commission because the Commission would wield much more power than it has in the past in this area. And this is also part of this instrument. And therefore, in the European Parliament, there is a strong push in favor of this, and actually to take even stronger measures than what is being proposed by the Commission. So the European Parliament seemed to be wanting, we need an instrument of that sort, and we need to give the Commission much more power in order for that instrument not to be sort of a vague instrument, but, you know, to really give the capability to the European Union through the Commission to act. Among the member states, among some of them, there is some hesitation. Because it's an hesitation of institutional nature, you know, in a sense, some transfer of power, of some power from member states to the European Commission. So the discussion is ongoing. I would expect that there will be an agreement, but, you know, where exactly it will go. So there will be an instrument of this sort, but the details, I think, are still to be worked out from a political viewpoint between parliaments and between the member states.
Thank you, André. And would be very interesting to hear what Tim thinks about this initiative from the EU, but also what has been Australia's set of tools for facing this kind of measures from other states.
Well, it's extremely interesting and helpful to hear André's explanation and commentary on the discussion on economic coercion here in Europe, and we certainly have been watching it very closely as well, particularly the work going on around the anti-coercion instrument. And in fact, Australia has taken the opportunity to comment publicly on the EU's proposed instrument. And I think in doing that, we've welcomed that the EU is exploring ways to respond more effectively and to deter economic coercion, and are keen to discuss how such instruments can best reinforce the rules-based multilateral trading system. And you said that, you know, we need to continue that discussion. I know that's an internal discussion, and we would certainly want to see the kind of directions that the EU takes here. But we welcome the discussion. How we've approached this, I've already mentioned some of the important ways we've been responding, and some of that is through like-minded cooperation, our efforts to strengthen global rulemaking to close gaps that we think are being exploited. And, you know, this is why the discussions at the WTO, difficult as they are, remain centrally important as far as we're concerned. But we also think it's very important to look at our series of economic and trade relations, and obviously including with China. And an important part of the response for us, in addition to working with like-minded partners globally, has been to actively look at ways of diversification of our trade to other markets. We, in fact, have had quite significant success I think that it's a surprise many that the way that Australia has responded to the economic coercion has been very positive, in the sense that we have looked for new markets. We've had success in that strategy, particularly looking at new markets in the region, building relationships, strong relationships that we already have. And many of the industries that have been targeted by the coercive measures have been able to find new markets. I mean, there's some that hasn't been the case, just a few, and we're working actively with those industries to look at ways of assisting them in their efforts to find new markets. And that gets me to a point around some of the more specific things that we're doing. And we have a very active strategy of negotiations, FTA negotiations. And as an example, we have just successfully concluded a very important negotiation with India, where some of those industries that have been the targets of coercion are beneficiaries of this kind of new agreement. And of course, we are very keen to progress our negotiation with the EU as well, because we do see it as an important to this diversification. It's important to build these new relationships in a trade and economic sense, but I think we all know that there's a broader strategic sort of interest that we have working cooperatively with like-minded countries, and we can do that bilaterally, regionally, and indeed multilaterally. And I think that's an overview of the kind of discussion that we want to promote, and the approach that we've been taking in response to the economic coercion that we've been facing.
So basically switching from negative tools to positive tools as well, to counteract this alternation that I was mentioning before. It's part of the same landscape. And perhaps we can go a little bit more in depth into those positive tools, because just mentioned about cooperation with the EU. And since May 2018, the Council of the European Union decided the opening of, opened the negotiations for a free trade agreement between the EU and Australia. And if I'm correct, we should be heading to the 13th negotiating round very soon. So it will be very interesting to hear from both you and André the state of play on that, and zoom in on this positive tool that we hope to have soon between Europe and Australia.
I'm very happy to go into a little bit more detail on the importance of that negotiation from an Australian perspective. And from our perspective as well, the situation we now face with the Russian invasion, the debate that's provoked in Europe about supply chains, about energy supplies, other supply chain related issues, I think that adds some potential for a new kind of discussion, a new momentum in the FTA. And we certainly are very keen to build momentum for the FTA negotiation. Notwithstanding we're in an election, it's an important priority of the government, and we would be looking to find a way forward as quickly as possible as we can after our elections. I'm sure that will be something that Australia wants to do. It reflects our view that the relationship is strong and has a lot of potential. For us, Europe is a very strong economic partner. I think we also see that it can bring benefits to Europe in terms of its engagement in the Indo-Pacific region, which I know is of increasing importance and significance, and there's a lot of thinking going on here as well about that. Investment is a key area that we think we can work together to strengthen the links. And I mean, the EU is already our second largest two-way trading partner. So I think that we want to move that discussion forward hoping that is something that Europe also sees in its strong interests. And we have been encouraged that there was a negotiating round earlier in the year. We hope to move into the next negotiating round as soon as possible in the second half of the year to advance this negotiation. I think As I mentioned, we've just concluded a negotiation with India. It was a very substantive economic and trade agreement with some very good outcomes for us, but it was equally a very important signal of strengthening of our economic and strategic relationship with India. And that's exactly what I think concluding an FTA with the EU would do as well.
It's very interesting that you mentioned about India, because very recently, on the 24th of April, the president of the European Commission went to India, and among the different things on the table, there is also discussions of trade cooperation with India. André, how do you see all this from the European perspective?
I'm not a trade negotiator, so I don't know at all the details of the preceding 12 rounds of negotiations between the EU and Australia. Maybe I can give some perspective from, you know, somebody like me who has been looking at trade and trade policy for 40 years, and also on the India relationship. Now, obviously, I do remember days, less happy days, because, you know, there are some happy days and less happy days, right? Not everything is rosy. So there were less happy days of relations, trade relations between Australia and the EU. It was very bitter, extremely bitter. I'm not saying that it was wrong from Australia's viewpoint, but it was very bitter, and it was centering on the common agricultural policy. Equal bitterness with the neighbor of Australia, New Zealand. And I can say that, you know, certainly New Zealand suffered. I don't know about Australia exactly, but I know New Zealand suffered terribly of the joining of the UK to the EU for its access to the UK market. And then, you know, by joining, in a sense, the common agricultural policy. But so we had very, very, very bitter relationship. And I remember any meeting that I had with my academic colleagues in Australia, and sometimes with officials in different positions that I have had, was always quite contentious. Now, that seems to be completely the past. So in a sense, it is happy days. They were, you know, tougher days, but, you know, now, indeed, when the negotiation was launched, three, 4 years back, I even met the Governor General on his visit here at the time, and I mentioned that to him as well, you know, that to me, it's a completely new outlook between Europe and Australia. You know, it's the bitterness has gone away. And I think for many, many reasons, both because of the evolution of our policies, both in Australian and European policies or domestic policies, and including on our part on about agriculture, and also as you mentioned, I think very rightly so, the geopolitical environment. So lots of things have changed that have made it even possible to start launching a negotiation between the EU and Australia that, you know, 30 years ago would have been unthinkable. Just unthinkable. I mean, people would have said, you know, no way. I mean, this thing is going to hit a rock, not after 12 rounds, but after one round, I mean, it's going nowhere. So no point starting. So here, you know, there's been 12 rounds and everybody is expecting that this is not, you know, round one after the other, not reaching a result. You know, everybody is expecting that this is going to be a successful negotiation, and we will sign a trade agreement, and a good trade agreement between Australia and the EU. Obviously, we are very far apart geographically. So the kind of relationship, and when I look at it as a trade economist, it's obviously a relationship that has to take into account the fact that we are so far away. So far away in geographical terms, but not in political terms, as we said before, we are like-minded. So, you know, we are like-minded, but very distant geographically. And that has certain implications, obviously, for the kind of relationship and the intensity of the economic relationship and, you know, the global value chain issue. But I think, as far as I know, things are progressing well. as you know, in a negotiation, there are some sticking points, but nothing that cannot be managed. The relationship with India is also an interesting element. So we have had for many years, we had a number of rounds of negotiation with the EU with India that was not going anywhere. It was a difficult negotiation, and at some stage the parties agreed that, you know, we should put it aside, that we are not going to conclude a deal. We were too far apart. We were not making progress. And already last year, through summits between the EU and India, also geopolitical changes, there has been new efforts, new willingness into trying to have discussions. As you very well know, there is also a negotiation between now India and the UK. So from the EU, we have been looking at the two deals, and India had not made any deals for quite a while. It stayed away from a major Asia-Pacific deal. So the signal coming from India was that, you know, India was not really willing to enter into trade deals. So indeed, from the vantage point of Brussels, the deal signed between India and Australia, and also between India and the UAE, this is information, okay? And so I'm sure the trade negotiators will be looking, and if I have a chance, I will also be looking at the deal between India and Australia to understand a little bit what is the quality of that deal, and what does it tell us about a potential deal with the EU. We obviously very much watching what's happening in the negotiation between the UK and India. That will be another part, and I'm sure the UK negotiators will have already have quite a bit of discussion with the Australian counterparts, and looking at the deal to see what it means for them, and therefore by ricochet, as we say, what it means for us. So this is a new environment, and this is, I think, all of this is extremely interesting and very, very important.
Thank you, André. And I have to be mindful of the time. So we are going towards the end of the episode, but I would still like to gather Tim last comments on what we just heard from André before we head to the conclusions.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity, because there are a few things I did want to say, because I think that what André was saying about the EU taking an interest in what we've achieved with India, I think there are lessons that might be useful for our own negotiation. And the first thing is, you're right, there's a history to our negotiation with Europe. There have been 12, 13, 14. There will be subsequent negotiating rounds, but we need to get this done as quickly as possible. And, you know, it suggests, you know, that this has been taking some time, but this is where I draw the parallel to India, where we started our negotiations with India, I think 2015, 2016, and it has been a long and hard, with ups and downs, negotiation. But towards the end of last year, through renewed engagement, particularly at a political level, at a very high political level for us as well, you know, ministers and prime ministers, this negotiation became unblocked, and it can move very quickly. And that's something we would like to see with the EU as well. And I mean, with India, you talked about the difficult issues that are often in negotiations, and that's always the case. But India, similarly, we had some areas where we thought it was going to be very difficult, in areas like agriculture, where we have really achieved quite significant outcomes, where we, you know, we are now, this is India's first FTA with a developed country in over 10 years. And it, I mean, as I've said previously, it reflects the complementarities of our two economies, but it's a substantive agreement. When it enters into force, it will cover 85% of Australia's goods exports to India, rising to almost 91% after 10 years. It has very good provisions, not only in goods, but also services. and some of these new strategic areas of interest, like, you know, that will promote supply chain building and resilience in areas like critical minerals and some of these other rare earths that are increasingly important. So it's a very forward-looking agreement as well. And I think it shows that these things can move quickly when there's the political will and commitment, and there's an understanding of the broader context in which these things are being done. So I think that there are lessons there, and we are extremely keen to build the same kind of momentum and outcomes with the EU.
Thank you so much. And at that stage, I really have to wrap up. And thanks a lot for you, Tim, to have joined us at the Sound of Economics here on our studio in Brussels. And of course, also thank you, André, for your insight and co-hosting this conversation with me. Stay tuned with the Sound of Economics, and I would like to remind you that all the analysis from our scholars are openly available on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks to all of you tuning in to listen to the Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.